This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. As always, Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Pope Jude, Jude Feld. And we are coming to you from our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and we do want to welcome everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, your tablet, any mobile device. It's all there for you at horseracingradio.net. And don't forget, a podcast of this program and all of our Trainer Talk shows available for you on our website as well. Well, as many of you know, we had the opportunity last weekend to venture northward to Canada to Woodbine Racetrack for the very first time here on the network. It was our second ever broadcast hosted from an international venue after going to Barbados earlier this year. And JT, I think you would agree with me, Woodbine rolled out the red carpet like no other racetrack. It was simply spectacular. We loved our trip. And how great was that Queen's Plate?
Yeah, it was fantastic all the way around. I've always wanted to go to Woodbine. Never had the opportunity until last week. And I was super impressed with the entire place. The staff at Woodbine, awesome. All the trainers were very engaging with us. We never had a straw in our path, really, the whole time we were there. And it was an excellent broadcast as well, if I do say so myself.
Don't break your arm patting yourself on the back.
It was a great show. It really was. And of course, you know, the race itself was spectacular. So just a great weekend for us. And everybody that attended, they broke records there in handle. They were up 36% after the fourth race.
Well, that's the power of HRN.
Yeah, that's right. Wherever we go, people fall.
You know, the other thing that always gets me, and we talked about it after we came back from Barbados, the pageantry surrounding these big races in other countries, it's second to none.
Yeah, it kind of makes American racing look a little boring.
Sometimes,
huh?
Yeah, but it does. I know the Derby has its, you know, its intricacies and its different pageantry surrounding the Derby. But beyond that, I mean, it's not like other countries when you show up in another country for an international event.
Yeah, it was absolutely beautiful. The horses and the Landau that they brought the lieutenant governor in on, yeah, and all of that stuff. It just beautiful, and it was a spectacular day. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better racing day as far as weather was concerned. The temperature was high 70s, low 80s. There was a little breeze. You know, a lot of people were wearing their finest clothes, and then you had, you know, some people in top hats and morning suits. It was awesome. It's just a great day.
Nobody knows about the pageantry and the history of Canadian racing better than our special guest for you tonight on Trainer Talk. He is trainer Mike Doyle. He is based at Woodbine. He has trained 1,034 career winners to date, and his runners are closing in on $38 million in purses. In 1984, Mike was honored with a Sovereign Award as Canada's leading trainer, and we are privileged to welcome Mike to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton, for you this evening. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you heard us talking about what Woodbine was like this past weekend with the Queen's Plate, and I know that you have been there for many, many years. You've seen your fair share of Queen's Plates. You participated in them. Look, I mean, this is truly a tremendous event, and if people haven't come there, they need to go.
Yeah, it's really a fantastic place to be, and it's a great place to train young horses. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place with many places to train them and take them. We have a spare turf course we can train on, and it's very, very, very good. It was nice on the weekend. I ran a filly in the race before the plate, She didn't run very well, unfortunately, but I was looking up at the grandstand, walking back across the turf course, and the place was full right to the top, which you very rarely see.
Well, you said you're
nice to see.
You said your filly didn't run very well. Well, she ran into Lexi Lou, right? Who ran a hole in the wind. That was incredible.
Yeah, she ran fantastic. My filly hadn't run since sort of last fall, and she had a little small surgery just to remove a little crack in the splint bone out. And she actually trained great. She found it a bit tough, and we just got to find an easier spot for her. That's all.
Well, it was a fantastic card. I mean, one race was better than the next, and everybody just seems to have such a good time up there. Now, is that a good face for Queen's Plate, or is that the way it is day in and day out?
Well, it's like most other places. They gear up for the bigger days, and they're trying to get people drawn to come, and they had some more social stuff going on, which seemed to help. I think they've done a great job, actually, this year, trying to put stuff like that together, and they had music afterwards. They had a little music, actually, just outside the paddock when I went over for our race. Our filly wasn't into the music much, but it was just one of those things. I think they're just something they're going to have to get used to a little bit and maybe work out how it works best and let the horses have their time to be ready. And but the crowd, you could just see coming in that the young people dressed sort of out like they were out for the day. It was quite warm, and a lot of people were outside mingling around the paddock, and they had stuff going on, little food booths and beer drinking booths and all sorts of stuff. It was kind of fun to see, you know.
It was very fun to see. Trainer Mike Doyle, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Mike, take us back to the beginning and your journey that led you to Woodbine. Where did your love of racing begin?
I was lucky. I was born into a nice family in Ireland of horse people, and I had three brothers, two of them in the horse business, one a trainer, Paul, trained in Ireland, unfortunately passed away. My brother Peter's a huge bloodstock agent in Europe and actually worldwide. His son Ross works for him. You can look him up, you'll see Peter and Ross Doyle Bloodstock. They're very, very big. And my father was he rode a bit. He trained some steeplechasers, and then he packed it in and became a bloodstock agent. He was very, very well regarded and had a great eye for a horse. And luckily, it's helped all of us along the way. I got itchy when I was young to get away from there. My father wanted me to be a vet. And I went and got accepted to vet school and vet college in Dublin. And we went and had a couple of pints at my uncle's pub one night, and I explained to him I didn't want to go to school anymore. So I started traveling with horses. I rode a bit. I wasn't very good at that. I was a big, useless amateur. But I traveled around a fair bit, and I got the urge to travel more. And I was going to Australia when I was 19 to work for Tommy Smith. And I got sick, and I couldn't go. And my father was in Canada doing some business with George Gardner, and a friend of mine managed the farm. And he said, why don't you send him out here for a while? So I went to Canada, and I stayed, you know. And I've been very, very lucky here and done very well.
You mentioned that you sat down with your uncle, and you told him that you didn't want to go to school anymore, and you decided that you wanted to get into the horse racing full-time. What was your parents' reaction to that decision?
I was with my father, actually, at my uncle's pub.
Oh, okay.
And he's the one that wanted me to become a vet, because one of my brothers was training. The other had an auctioneering business, and my other brother was getting into the bloodstock end of it with him. And I was we were from a rugby family. We all played rugby, and it was rugby and horses. So rugby, horses, and uncles with pubs. You can imagine what was going on there. You know?
Sounds like the perfect life, actually.
Yeah, it was until I was 20. and the travel, I enjoyed the travel part. I was lucky to do a lot of traveling. And traveling with horses, dropping them off in different places, and Turkey, Cyprus, traveled through Europe on a train delivering horses. We just had a lot of fun. And it was just, I just had an urge to go somewhere, you know. And so I came out here, and I worked at Gardner Farms for about 9 months. And then I went and managed a little farm for an Irish fellow in St. Catharines, and we did great there. And then I came to the racetrack and worked for a beautiful old Irish guy called Jim Bentley, who was a beautiful guy. And then I got a job as assistant at Kinghaven Farm at the track. And from there, Mark Frosted's father, Mark Frosted, who trains, his dad asked me if I'd take his babies to Florida for him, so I did. And we turned that into me training them, and that's how I started, you know?
I can imagine that your world travels and getting to see different parts of the world with the horses you were bringing around had to be extremely beneficial when you came across the pond, so to speak, and started getting into the business, was it?
Oh, it was, yeah, it was fantastic. Just to see, you know, how things were done in different places. Obviously, growing up in Ireland, you know, it's a bit, it's different there. You know, you do everything. You groom them, you muck them out, you rub them, you get on them, and you even ride some of them, drive the van, you know. You sort of, you do it all, really. You help making the hay and getting the feed in. You might even help taking a few fillies off to be bred and waiting for them to be bred and bringing them home and foaling a few mares, the whole lot. We also had some greyhounds that we used to race a little bit. And it was all sort of the last move you made on most days like that was to stop for a couple of pints on your way home.
This is becoming a recurring theme with this show, Mike.
It is. There's nothing wrong with that, actually.
Not at all.
That's especially nice. If you lose all your money at the track and your uncle owns a pub, you can always get a pint or two.
the word slate was very well known in these places, you know? So it was all right.
Well, it sounds like you kind of jumped in with both feet when you made the decision to get into the business. You mentioned some extremely prominent names with Kinghaven and with Mark Frosted. Tell me about working with those types of people.
You know, I was working at the track for Jim Bentley, who is a very well known. He trained for Winfields, a lot of horses for Winfields, and we had some nice horses. We had a lovely old horse called Military Bearing, who Norcliffe beat in the Queen's Plate, just beat him. Avelina Gomez rode our horse, and we had other good horses as well. So I had the pleasure of working with good horses there, and I did a little bit of everything. And I went from being groom to and galloping to being his assistant two or three different times, and then I went to Kinghaven, and I was there. They changed trainers, and they kept me on with the new guy that started. It was Art Warner, actually, who had come from Maryland. And, you know, so there was another opportunity for me to see and learn different things, you know?
Yeah, well, the more people that you work for, I think the better your knowledge and focus is when you go out on your own. A lot of times we'll have trainers on and they've grown up, you know, their father was a trainer and they only worked for him. But if you branch out a little bit and see how other people do things, I think it really helps.
Yeah, no, it's very, very important that young people getting into this game, that they work for somebody, stay as long as they can, and if the time comes, they just talk to that person, and maybe they can help them go somewhere else where they could find a nice job, where they could learn more, you know what I mean, as opposed to drifting from place to place, you know?
Yeah.
Mike, how beneficial was it to have your entire family involved in the sport and to be able to come back and, you know, talk with them about different things that have happened?
I mean, it was just a great environment, actually, to grow up in. Like I said, we're a rugby family, and my uncles are all rugby, and my cousins. My father played rugby for Ireland, and my cousin Tony played rugby for Ireland. He was a scrum half. And we all played, like, day and night rugby, day and night horses. We tried to fit going to school in there as much as we could, and it was just a great way to grow up.
Well, it's such a beautiful country and one that's immersed in horse racing. And
yes.
So it's there's a racetrack right around the corner no matter where you are. So it's just got to be. I'm kind of jealous listening to this life story. It's pretty cool, really.
And a little bit of traveling around the world was very helpful also. You know, like going to Singapore, you know, when you're a kid. Singapore, Turkey, Nicosia, Cyprus. I mean, you wouldn't never sort of place Cyprus as a place that had horses, but they had a racetrack in Nicosia, and we brought 36 horses. My father sold them to a guy. I even remember his name. The man's name was Papa Georgiou. And, you know, just at the time, there was war in that part of the world, and the UN were in Nicosia. So walking back through the streets after dropping all the horses off and trying to find a hotel and soldiers, armed soldiers and tanks up and down the streets, it was just an odd experience. I was about 16 at the time, and it was sort of something to see, and then going racing the following week before we left. It was just a neat experience, you know?
Yeah, those international connections, have they helped you throughout your career?
I think my father's connection helped me a lot more than anything, his connection with his business. I got horses to train when I started. I started going to Florida pretty early in my training career in the wintertime, and I had horses at Gulfstream and some at Payson Park, and Roger Atfield and I are great mates, and we had sort of trailers beside each other in the trailer park in Indiantown when we first started, and we had horses there, and I started taking some to Gulfstream as well, and I'd get horses that would come from there for the winter, and the first good one I had was a horse called Marold. He won the Manhattan Handicap in New York. First time I ran him in New York, paid $126. It was a really nice day. And Super Sunrise, he won the Canadian Turf Handicap at Gulfstream. He was about the third year that I trained. And he had come from England. The guy wanted $50,000 for him. And I sold him for $450 to Mr. Levy, who owned Atlantic City, Bob Levy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good horse for him, too. He went on to New York, won the Red Smith, and he was second in his race in Atlantic City, the United Nations. He won and placed in many stake races around that area, you know.
Wow. Didn't Marold give you your first graded stakes win, too?
He did, indeed. Yes, he did. I have an old picture in there. I'm sorry to say, it's black and white, which is pretty scary. And Horatio Luro, I was in his barn. He was a friend of Mr. Frosted, and he took care of me like his son. And he came in the picture with me. It's something I cherish. He was such a beautiful man.
Yeah, that was the 1980 Niagara Handicap at Woodbine, now known, by the way, as the Northern Dancer Turf Stakes.
That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, big win, Marold. What was, Mike, when you think back on that day, and after all the time and effort and travel that you put in to get to that point, to finally break through with that first grade of stakes win, what was that day like?
It was great. It was an odd. I had a phone call with Mr. Frost, and I called him and said, I think this could be a really good horse. He'd come from France, and we gelded him. He had a bit of trouble with that part of his equipment, so we got rid of that. And he blossomed and got big and strong, put on a bunch of weight. He got sort of sounder and just sort of gradually got better. And I ran him in Florida, and he won at Calder. And I didn't get to run him much more, and I can't remember where I ran him next, but I decided I'd run him in the Penn Governor's Cup or something at Penn National, and he ran into a horse called Told, who broke the world record for a mile and a 16th, and he was fifth, beating about two lengths. And he said to me, what are you going to do with him now? I said, well, I'm still at Penn National, but I'm going to get a van, take him to New York. Let's run him in the Manhattan Handicap. It's in a week. And he said, a week? Are you crazy or what? I said, I don't think so. He came out of the race great, and I said, we weren't really hard on him for this, you know. I think he'll run better now. Anyway, and he went and he won the race. He was in front all the way and paid $126.
Run him back in a week. Dude, that's music to your ears.
Oh, yeah, I love that. There's nothing better. I mean, these guys nowadays, they need, you know, 3 months between starts. I don't get it, but hats off to you for sticking to your guns and running back in a week. That's fantastic.
Yeah, you can't do it much anymore. I don't know if the horses are made up quite the same way. You know, this is an old horse. He was a 5 or 6 year old gelding. He was a tough old dude, and it took me a long time to get him to where he was in good order. And when he ran at Penn, he kind of half needed the race, but he came out of the race so well, it was almost like a good work, you know.
Yeah, that's perfect. And a lot of times, people don't realize that the horses sometimes after they run, if they don't run too hard, they're almost incontrollable. I mean, you get a horse like that and you get them feeling good and they run that race, and then all of a sudden you can't hold them on the ground. So why not run them back? Why break them down training them?
Well, I mean, like, you make a point, and everybody now is at least 3 weeks between races, just about, and a lot of guys are 6 weeks between races. And look, if you have the people who wait, I think it's a great way to go if you can, and you're taking care of your horse and doing the best thing you can for him. But every once in a while, you got to take a shot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mike, are horses that much different now than they were, say, 40 years ago?
I think, I don't know, the horses are as tough as they used to be. I don't think they are. And I don't really know what the reason for it is, but maybe it's watered down some. I can't explain it. I've been very lucky to have some very good horses over the years. And, you know, seeing one that can take a little more than the others, it's nice when you find one, because, you know, when you run them back in sort of 3 weeks, it's not a lot for them, you know?
I thought it was interesting in the Queen's Plate this year that two of the horses had 8 starts. That was the most in the field. And they ran first and fourth. They both ran bang-up races, but they were the horses with seasoning as opposed to the ones that came in with, like, 2 or 3 starts. Well, 3, I think, was the minimum, 3 and 4 starts. But yeah. But the seasoned horses, they could get that mile and a quarter, where some of the other ones came up short.
Yeah, and anytime you run, you know yourself, anytime you run a young horse like that far, I mean, you could probably draw a line through half the field. Not that you can see it when you read the form, but if you had a little bit of hindsight, if you could look at it sort of at the quarter pole while the race is running, you could probably run your pen through half the field, because half of them don't get the trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty hard race for a young horse, a mile and a quarter.
Mike, have you had to make some changes in your approach to training horses, in particular young horses, because of the fact that maybe horses aren't quite as tough as they were back, you know, four or five decades ago?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's something to be said for always taking your time with them. I mean, I think when you get the opportunity to take your time, you're going to wind up with a better horse at the end of the day if they make it and get through all the hoops they have to get through, soundness-wise and racetrack surface-wise and, you know, stress-wise, going to the paddock and everything that goes with training them. I don't know about much more you can do. Just being careful and taking your time is probably the biggest thing, really.
Talking with trainer Mike Doyle on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All right, Mike, you mentioned Marold and how good he was in 1980, giving you your very first stakes win. How about your first winner, which came a couple years earlier in 1978? Tell me about that day.
Yeah, he was just a little horse that they had, and, you know, he wasn't great, but he won a nice maiden race here. It was a very exciting moment. I was certainly very excited to see that I could actually train a winner, you know. And I acted accordingly and celebrated afterwards a little bit. And and then I got lucky not that long after that. I had a couple of more winners, so I knew it wasn't a complete fluke.
I remember when I won my first race, that's the first thought that crossed my mind. I can actually do this.
And, yeah, exactly.
And it was kind of a relief in a way, because until that happens, you don't know. And I had some friends that went like 0 for 42 before they won their first race. And I got lucky and won my second start. And it was like a relief almost that you could actually possibly make a living doing this.
Yeah, I mean, Megan, you gotta be careful doing this, that you don't actually start thinking that you really know what you're doing, because the horses are so fickle, and you learn every day as you go along. You just learn something new, you know.
Absolutely,
Mike. How did you know the time was right to go out on your own?
I had probably about 16 or 18 horses for George Frosted, Mark's dad, and I was kicking along at a pretty good tilt. We were actually doing really well, and the two-year-olds I brought back all ran well when I ran them, which got me off to a really good start. And that was the second year. And I had a couple of calls, and the people just assumed I was private, which I kind of was, but I wasn't really. I was just getting a check, you know what I mean? And I explained to one of the people who called me that I could work for you privately, too, if you really want. This was an Arab called DK Youssef. He said, oh, I'd like that. So I just put him in beside me there with another 20 horses, and I charged him a wage as well. I just got some more staff and worked away at it myself, and he paid the staff. And that worked for about a year, and then I added some more horses. And Mr. Frosted was keen with it, no problem. And that's how I wound up training for Eaton Hall Farm, who I still train for today. And they've been very good to me. We had Bessarabian running the first Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, tell me about that relationship, because you mentioned it goes back, you know, several years. Talk about having a client like that that you developed this long-term relationship with.
Yeah, they had some horses with an elderly guy training here called Tommy Anderson, a good guy. And they had a guy that sort of ran their business for them. They were just getting into horse business, and there's an Irish fella called Tom Webb. Tom asked me if I could take a couple of horses, and I said, what about Tommy Anderson? And he said, well, we're going to take him off Tommy. I said, I don't want to do that. I like Tommy, so I'm just going to pass. So I passed for a couple of weeks, and I ran into them at the races, and they were with Tommy. And Tommy, in front of them, said, Mike, you should take those horses. So they had spoken to Tommy, and he was cool with it, so it was okay that way. I just didn't like it the first way, you know?
Right, right.
And we won some races, and then Tom Webb and I bought Bessarabian. I actually sent some yearlings. I went all to Gulfstream one winter. I think it was 83 or 82 or something. Anyway, I took all my horses to Gulfstream and didn't go to Payson. So I sent six babies to Tony Everard in Ocala, who I'd gotten to know very well. And he called me one day and said, who's vice regent? I said, well, he's the best stallion in Ontario, in Canada here. He said, I got one down here, and she's not a Canadian bred, she's a Pennsylvania bred, and these people don't like her. He said, I've got 150 of them down here. You better come up and have a look at her. I think she's the best one. So I got in the car the next day and drove up, and he put me to work all morning. I got on about 12 horses for him, and eventually I got on her, and I just scalped her a little bit, and I liked her. And she was sold in the March 2-year-old sale at Hialeah, and we bought her for $122,000. She was a superstar.
Yeah, the rest is history. We're going to continue to talk more about Bessarabian and some of the other top horses that trainer Mike Doyle has had the privilege to be around in his career. We'll do that when we come back. Stay with us. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. In 2015, the Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales outperformed all major North American yearling sales. The July sale held in Lexington, Kentucky is annually a top-ranked yearling sale by percentage of graded stakes winning graduates and saw 15 sires represented by their highest-priced colt or filly in 2015. The prestigious Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale posted an increased average of over $322,000 while boasting a remarkably low RNA rate of just 15% and was tremendously strong in the middle market with a higher percentage of horses sold in the $100,000 to $300,000 range than book one of the Keeneland September sale. The New York bred sale in Saratoga produced 50 yearlings of $100,000 or higher with an increased average of more than $81,000. The Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales. Superior results. Visit FasigTipton.com. Kentucky Downs kicks off a unique 5-day all-grass race meet in September. Live racing September 3rd, 8th, 10th, 11th, and 15th. And the stakes are high with $7.8 million in purses over the 5 days, an average of $1.56 million each day. Kentucky Breds will run for maiden special weight purses of $130,000 and allowance purses of $145,000. Maidens not bred in Kentucky will compete for $58,000 with top allowance for non-Kentucky Breds at $67,000. Learn more at KentuckyDowns.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Catch great thoroughbred action at Woodbine Racetrack. 2016 marks Woodbine's 60th year of thoroughbred racing, and the early pick four will be guaranteed at $100,000 on Saturdays and Sundays and $50,000 on Fridays. Plus, Woodbine will be offering 20-cent bet minimums on all Triactor, Superfecta, Pick 3, and Pick 4 pools. And try your luck with the Thoroughbred Pick 5 and the Jackpot High 5. It's all there at WoodbineRacetrack.com. That's WoodbineRacetrack.com.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, enjoying our visit with trainer Mike Doyle on the program here this evening. And if you did miss any portion of the first half of the show, or you just want to go back and listen again, you can listen to the entire show via podcast at horseracingradio.net. You can also check us out, Horse Racing Radio Network, on iTunes, and listen at your leisure to this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. And by the way, not just Trainer Talk, you can listen to Jock Talk, our call-in shows, our Weekend Stakes preview shows, all of those shows available for you via podcast at horseracingradio.net.
Yeah, a lot of people tell us that they go running and listen to them, or listen to them in the car on their way to work. It's great. Yeah. I love it. I love it.
To me, that kind of struck me as funny when people would say, I go for a run and I listen to your podcast, right? Because that's not very upbeat. I mean, well, we try to keep it upbeat, but it's not like listening to, Rocky Five or something, right? Eye of the Tiger. Right, it's not like listening to that.
Not everybody's that dramatic when they run. Some people run to clear their mind.
Well, I used to run to old Tom Durkin race calls.
Well, see, oh, and then you would pretend you were a horse and
the problem was run. Right, he would be really mellow in the first part of the race, and then he would build up to a crescendo in the stretch. Mm-hmm. So I'd be going along at a comfortable pace, which for me is like a 22-minute mile, and then I would pick it up to like a 20-minute mile in the stretch. And then I'd be exhausted when he'd go to the next call and he'd start, and they're off. So it was up and down for me.
You couldn't fire a bold opening salvo?
No. Mike Doyle is with us from Canada here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike, did you ever do anything crazy like that as a kid?
We had certain things. I mean, some Irish music has great beat to it. You know, you'd sort of get things going and do it to the beat of the Irish music. It was kind of before rugby matches and stuff to get wound up, you know?
Who's the team that they sing the Fields of Athenry? Isn't there a rugby team that's like their theme song?
Well, it's basically anytime Ireland plays England in Dublin, it just goes on and on. It never ends, you know.
So do you and Atfield have a big bet going when that match is played?
Oh, yeah. Not just Atfield and I. I have a little place I go in Fort Lauderdale called Waxy O'Connor's. It's on 17th Street Causeway. A friend of mine, Mark Rolliter, owns it. And there's a bunch of English lads who work on the boats go in there. We get wicked amounts of gambling going on during the Six Nations rugby in the wintertime there.
Oh, we gotta make that appearance when we're down at Gulfstream.
We
have to do that. Believe me, you'll never go anywhere else. It's a great spot.
Do the Italians have a rugby team?
hey, they do. Believe it or not, they're actually one of the Six Nations, and they've improved greatly over the last 10 or 15 years.
Really? Really?
Yes,
What's the most memorable rugby match you can remember being involved with?
We play when I went to school. We used to play. I went to a school called Presentation College Bray. It was the Presentation Brothers, and the coaches were all Presentation Brothers and stuff. Anyway, so we'd play rugby. We used to play Pres Cork, which was down in the west coast of Ireland, and they'd come up and play us, and we'd go down and play them. And when they came up, we'd take them out and feed them full of Guinness, and then we'd beat the crap out of them the next day. They'd be puking all over the place. And when we'd go to Cork, they'd feed us full of Murphys. And the same thing had happened. They'd try and crush you down there. You know, it was just a lot of that kind of thing, you know?
That's great.
Mike Doyle on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. All right, Mike, we left off talking about Bessarabian and how good she really was. Of course, a millionaire back in 1986. Tell me about her and what made her so good.
Yeah, she was by that horse, Vice Regent, who was a phenomenal sire here. And, you know, he had horses go all over America and win. And he's become a great broodmare sire. You see him in a lot of stuff. You just pick up a form one day, some of the bigger races at Woodbine, and have a look at the pedigree. If you go back, you'll see Vice Regent prominent in the along the female side, you know. And she was just a really laid back. She was beautiful, and it took her four starts to break her maiden. I mean, I got tired of betting 200 on her when I ran her the first three or four times. I got tired of it, and anyway, then I ran her in a stake at Fort Erie, and she just galloped. She won by 10. And I knew that that was what I was seeing all along. And from there, she won a race at another stake at Woodbine called the Mazarine. And there was Dave Stevenson was here, and he was working for Sheikh Mohammed. It was in the very early years of that stuff. And he grabbed me and said, would those guys sell that horse? And I said, Dave, these people have got a lot of money. They own the biggest stores across Canada, and they're really nice guys, and this is like one of our first nice horses. I don't think they would. I think he said, "How would $1 million do it?" I said, "No, not a chance." So I just went back to the table, and I see him waving at me. So I go over to see him again. He said, "How about $2 million?" So I went back and I said, "Listen, how about $2 million?" "I don't think so. Ask for $3 million." So I go back and say, "How about $3 million?" And they said, "Give us a couple of minutes." He said, "Look, I'm going to call you from New York tomorrow." He called me the next day and he said, "We'll give $3 million for her." So I went to meet them downtown. I said, "Look, you know, this is probably a great price. In this day and age, it's just, you don't get $3 million for a horse, you know what I mean? But, you know, we're going to go to the Breeders' Cup if everything stays good." And they just said, "Like, we went, let's just go to the Breeders' Cup. It doesn't matter. We don't need the money." So I phoned Dave and I said, "They won't take it. I'm sorry. They just won't sell it." They called me like 10 minutes later. They said, "Well, they take $4 million. I said, "I'm not even going to ask them because they won't." You know what I mean? So that was kind of the end of it. It was the first time I realized how much you could get for a very nice horse, having trained some horses that were okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, that had to be a tough turn down for you.
it really was. These are beautiful people. And I still, there were two brothers, and then it became one brother, just because the one guy wasn't as interested. And I trained for Thor Eaton. I still do today. He has five horses here, and we have a couple of nice babies and one nice filly by Leroy DeSanimo. But he wasn't interested. You know, he just, let's have a bit of fun, you know?
Yeah. Well, when you have a lot of money, there's nothing beats having a good horse. I mean, that's why people get in the game, so.
Yeah, he liked having a jar, too, so it was easy to have a few jars and go to races and have a little punt, and if you win or lose, you get a couple of more jars, and away you go. You know?
I love your style.
Well, she had plenty of seasoning when she made it to the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies in 1984. You mentioned that being the first Breeders' Cup ever held at Hollywood Park that year. She had 9 starts under her belt. She came out of that big win in the Gardenia at the Meadowlands. And yep. Tell me about going down that road to the Breeders' Cup and what that experience was like.
I was trying to set a sight on it because when she won here, she was ultra-impressive. And I thought that was a good way for me to get there. It was an important race. And as it turned out, the filly that was favorite at that time for the Breeders' Cup was a filly that Clyde Rice had, I think. And I can't remember her name, but that's who we beat. But she beat her by 9 or 10 lengths in the slop. And my filly, I stayed around there for a day or two, and then I flew her from there to California. And she came up with this awful, nasty skin disease. And she didn't have a mark on her, you know, when we went to the Meadowlands. Just one of those things. And anyway, between dealing with that, and she just maybe wasn't her best Breeders' Cup day, even though she wound up being the favorite at post time. And I think she was fourth and moved up, or fifth moved up to fourth, or sixth moved up to fifth. There was an inquiry or something. She was involved in a little thing, but it didn't really affect her much, you know?
Yeah, well, she was so spectacular. And then I remember she came back, what, the following year in 85, and she ran in the Coaching Club American Oaks that year. She ran second behind future Hall of Famer Mom's Command. So she ran into a buzzsaw that day, too.
Yeah, she did. And she was ridden by Mr. Fuller's daughter.
Abby.
She made her first start. I actually sent her to Ocala. She had a splint in each. She came out of the Breeders' Cup with a little splint below her knee on both legs in front. And she popped a curb behind. So I had to deal with the curbs and the splints. So I took her to Ocala and kicked her out, and we did the splints. We fired them back then instead of nowadays you freeze fire them. And I fired her curbs, too. And then I brought her to Gulfstream, and I got to know Shug and Rusty Arnold and Phil Oswald and Sam Raymer, Stanley Huff. These are all mates of mine from Florida, from going down many years ago and going to Kentucky and stuff. And we're all great friends today. And we had a lot of fun. They all knew how much I thought of her. So we all bet on her when we ran her in the Hibiscus at Hialeah, and she won by there. Jose Santos rode her. I think it was maybe his second ride in America. He spoke no English. I had his guy Joe, I can't remember his surname, come into the paddock and tell him, don't beat her up too much. I really like her. If she doesn't win, it's not the end of the world. It's just a comeback race. And when he got off her, he couldn't stop talking. He didn't have one word of English. I didn't have any idea what he was talking about.
Well, it was only a couple of years after that, I guess 1989, which was a tremendous year for you, Mike, because you come back with Canadian Oaks winner Blonde in a Motel, and then you had the champion 2-year-old filly of that year, Wavering Girl. Tell me about what was happening in 89.
I had become very good friends with David Greathouse, the Greathouse family in Kentucky. They're great friends of mine.
Sure.
And my family. And David and I were very close friends. He unfortunately passed away. And Johnny is a very good friend of mine, and David's son, Deuce, and David's wife, the whole family anyway. And I made a habit of buying a yearling off them every year if I could. And I bought 6 stake winners in a row, buying 1 yearling a year off them and never paying much money for them. And Wavering Girl was one of those to give $32,000 for. She was freaky, too. She was really, really nice.
Well, David Greathouse, what a cool man he was. And
oh, the best.
Yeah.
We were really, really, really good friends. We did a lot of things together. Fishing, golfing, having large amounts of pints, and betting on horses. And he'd come up and stay with me and play golf. And he'd come to the barn. He'd stay all day at the barn with you if you wanted. You know, he just loved being around horses. And what a great feel for the game he had for every aspect of it. It's unfortunately there aren't a lot of people like him left, you know.
Yeah, always had a smile on his face, no matter win, lose. It didn't matter. He just loved the game so much.
Yeah, he was the greatest.
Yeah, the entire Greathouse family,
just
good people.
I tell you a quick story. He called me after the sales in Kentucky. I'd gone home and I might have bought a couple off them, and I bought 5 or 6 euros. And about 3 days later, I used to call him Fatty all the time. So Fatty called me. He says, "Hey, Dollar, I bought one back." I said, "Great, man. What'd you buy?" He said, "I bought one by Scatmandu. I really like him." I said, "Okay, great. When are you going to send them up?" I said, "We'll get them broke. We'll send them up there in the spring. Or if you're going to Payson, take them to Payson." I said, "Sure, no problem." So he called me in the spring. This is after seeing them all winter. He said, "I got a name for that horse." I said, "What are you going to call him?" He said, "Fat Man Do." I thought it was great. The horse wasn't much, but it was a great name.
Perfect. Mike Doyle on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on HRRN. Mike, tell me the story of Wild Gal, who took you to the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont Stakes in 1993.
Yeah, that was a interesting story. I was training for a guy from Toronto who was in the medical waste business, but he lived in the Bahamas for some reason, something to do with taxes, I suppose. I don't know, I never asked him. Anyway, he was a pretty good guy, and I told him I was going over to the wholesale, and he said, "Well, call me later, maybe we'll buy one." So a bunch of us went to play golf. It was a dark day in Florida, and the sale started it was on Tuesday, so we played golf somewhere in Miami Lakes or something. A bunch of us, we stopped at a place with music and other stuff on the way back to have a pint, and Phil Oswald said to me, "I think the sale starts in about an hour." I said, "Oh, shit, I got to be at the sale. I forgot completely." And I was driving over to sale, and Rusty Arnold called me and said, "Hey, listen, I looked at a bunch over there. I looked at a nice Wild Again." And he said, "So-and-so's buying." So I just went there, looked at him. I looked at a whole bunch of others, for the next day and all that stuff. And he was in the second day. And I liked him a little bit. And I went to look at him the next day, and I liked him a lot. And I phoned the guy and said, "I found a nice Wild Again a friend of mine really liked. And he had somebody for him but doesn't have anybody now." And, anyway, make a long story short, we gave $100,000 for him. So I stayed back a little while in Florida, and I ran him a Calder, and he was third or fourth, but he ran well. And then I took him to Toronto, and he did well. And in the fall, I ran him in the race in Kentucky, and at the time, it was called the Jockey Club, I think. I think it was called the Jockey Club or something like that, anyway. So I ran him in there, and it was $1 million bonus if you won that. It was the Brown and Williamson something or other. If you won that and ran in the Derby and won it, there was $1 million bonus. So my guy was in. He flew up on his plane from the Bahamas. I went back to the Bahamas with him for a couple of days. And I said, "Look, we got to make a plan. I don't know if this horse is good enough. We got to run. Think about running the Derby." And all he could talk about was betting on him. In the wintertime, he wanted to bet on him in Vegas, and bet on him in Nevada, and Reno, and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, so I took him to Florida. He was second his first start up. I had him at Payson, and then I brought him in the Gulfstream. I kept him there after I ran him. And he was, he was sort of okay horse. You know, he wasn't a superstar, but he was a relentless closer. And we go to the Derby, and he called me one day, and he said, "I bet on the horse for you." He said, "I bet on him in Vegas." I said, "Great. What's your bet for me?" Like, thinking, I'd say you bet $100 for me or something. He said, "I bet $1,000 for you." I said, "That's great. What price did you get?" He said, "I could only get 200-1. So I said, "Well, that's nice." So I'm down. I'm thinking to myself, 1,000, 200. Well, I like that. Needless to say, I worked very hard. And we go to the Derby. Anyway, the horse was third. He ran very well. Shane Sellers came back and said, "Mike, you probably know, you're going to hear this all the time." He said, "If he gets through, he wins." D-Hero won it. And they both went. He came up the fence. We were on the outside closing. And they went for the same hole. And C-Hero kind of got there first, and he got stopped and shuffled back a ways, and he came back on to finish third. He just got beat, I think, ahead for second. Prairie Bayou, or I think it was some Bayou or something, was second.
Yeah, well, with $1,000 at 200-1, it must have made you sick when Shane Sellers told you that.
Well, and he meant it, too. He was, when I saw the rerun, he was bang on. Whether he'd have actually won or not, I don't know, but he would have been a lot closer. And we had a lot of fun with the horse, and then I had a chance to sell him for a lot of money, and that would have been a big day. And the guy decided he wanted to keep him because he named him after his girlfriend, Gale, G-A-L-E. So anyway, at the end of the day, we sold them in a sale. Fatty sold them for us at the November sale as a stallion prospect. We got 70 for him to go to Louisiana.
Mm.
But all the rest of it was nice. He was third in the Belmont as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite a horse. He could really run.
Yeah.
What a nice horse. Yeah, he could run. He was, you know, he was short on being a really good horse, but he was trying to be a nice horse.
Well, you had a time shortly after that, Mike, where you actually stepped away from training horses for a while. You took on another position. Tell me about that time period in your life.
I got to know Frank Stronach pretty well, and he grabbed me at the races one day, and he was a big player, and he just said, "Mike, I want you to train some for me." I said, "Sure." So, you know, we had the same sort of thing again. He wanted me to take a couple of horses that all the guys had. I didn't really want to do it because I knew them. I've gotten to know a lot of people. I don't like trampling on anybody if I can help it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, anyway, he said, "Okay, now I understand." So, anyway, he sent me a couple of other horses, and we had a few winners. And then he started talking to me about wanting to come with me and would do more, like manage it for me, because we've got too many horses. So I went up to the farm one day and we spent a couple of hours, went through that. I got a little package of the racehorse. There were 409, I'll never forget it, 497 horses. That included the babies. And so I made a deal with them. I made a pretty good deal for myself for 3 years. And I managed that for them. And I had a lot to do with buying the young horses, which is the thing I really liked and I still like today. I love buying young horses. And we did great, and we bought a lot of really good horses. And Frank went from fifth or sixth to second to first in the 3 years. And he was leading breeder. He was always wanting to be the leading breeder, and he did a great job of getting there. And he was relentless in his pursuit of great things in the horse business. And you can see how he's taking it on with the racetracks, you know?
Yeah, and didn't you guys win a... You won a Sovereign Award together as the top owner, and then you won the Queen's Plate in 94 together, right?
Yeah, Danny Vella still trains for Frank, and Danny was the trainer of Basquien, yes. But we had a lot of good horses, really, really good horses. I'd been there about 2 years, and we're doing good, and he said to me one day, I said, "I want you to take the horses, really, to the somewhere, pick the best 45 or 50 and take them away. You get them ready over the winter." And I said, why would I let the guys that have them do it? But I want you to do it. I said, "Okay, Alex." So I said, "Well, I'm going to train them, right?" He said, "Yeah, you're going to keep doing what you're doing, but you're going to train these horses too." "Okay, all right." So I took 45 horses to New Orleans. And what a town. That's my favorite town in the world. So I love New Orleans, and I love being there. We had all those Awesome Again, Wild Rush, Relaxing Rhythm, Holtzmeister, I can't even remember them all. There were just so many nice horses.
Wow.
And then he decided we'd pass them out again. So back to Keenan, had a bunch there, and he gave them all out. So at the end of that year, like, I was done. So there was no chat about me doing any more for him. So I started collecting some more horses to train. I started training, and he left me some horses to train. And when I ran them out, I just got back doing my own thing, which I prefer to do anyway. And we stayed very, very friendly and pally over the years. And I've done a few things for him on and off. And as it turns out, I'm sort of consulting for him at the moment. And I'm helping him manage his racing stable now as well.
Wow, that's a good role.
Yeah, and I mean, I train my own horses, and you know, and I like all the people who train here, and I'm here anyway. I have 40 horses here, my own, that I am involved in myself, and for the owners I've had for years, and I help sort of Frank's outfit with just putting together where they go, what they do, when to go to the farm, you know, the usual stuff that goes with having a lot of racehorses, you know.
Mike Doyle here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike, this has really flown by. Only about 5 minutes left in the program. I want to go back and talk about something you just touched on, though. You said you love picking out young horses. So when you do get the opportunity to do that, what are a couple of the key things that you're looking for?
There's something about it when you do a lot of it. And my father was the greatest person I've ever known at it. And I think I picked up a few things, and I don't know why I did. I just did. And there's something about the horse's presence when they pull out. Just looking at them, you see something. It's hard to explain, you know. You look for certain things. And it's not always complete correctness and stuff like that. You know, you can always forgive a horse tone out a little bit, or even maybe a little tone in, more tone out than in, but great walk, just nice head, nice balance, simple stuff, you know. Buy a nice horse out of a nice mare that you knew, or you train one out of the family, you know, stuff like that came from families that showed up a lot in the afternoon. I think that means a lot also.
Yeah, a lot of times, at least for me, it's like when you see a girl, you know right away whether you'd want to date her or not, at least superficially. But they bring those horses out, and you know right away whether you like them or not.
Yeah, I think you get sort of thing. You get to liking, you know, you get to liking a color. It's not that you buy a horse because it's chestnut or something, or you see a gray, I've got to have that. It's just when you do see a certain type, like a really good dark bay or something, you just got to have another look. And maybe you start forgiving them for some things, especially if you like the pedigree and they have a nice walk. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and they look at you. Their eyes, I think, are important.
Yeah, the eyes have a nice bit of room between their eyes, nice big ear. You know, nice sharp muzzle. Just carry themselves nicely conformed and as best you can. The walk is a big thing, I think. Balance, all that sort of stuff.
Well, Mike, I can tell you this has really been an enjoyable hour, and I think so many people will enjoy hearing your story. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you receive a gift from one of our sponsors. That's Flair Equine Nasal Strip, so we'll send those up to you. Always like to end, though, with the last minute or so by asking trainers what it is they like to do outside of the racetrack. I know you're a big rugby fan, but any other interests that you have that you like to do when you get away from Woodbine for a little bit?
Yeah, I'm not a very good swimmer, but I like going for a swim. And I love to play golf. And I love watching any sport. I like all sports, and I'm a big music person. I love all kinds of music. And I love going for a few pints and listening to music.
Well, I'll tell you what. The next time we're in the same location together, we're going to go ahead and invite you out. We'll have a few pints. We'll listen to some music. And we'll continue this visit in private afterwards.
Absolutely. And hopefully I get back to Florida, and if you're all around Gulfstream, make sure you flag me down and I'll introduce you to Waxy O'Connors.
All right.
You
sounds
got it.
Good.
Mike, thanks so much. We really appreciate the time, and best of luck moving forward, my friend.
I appreciate it, mate. Thanks a lot. See you later.
All right. Trainer Mike Doyle here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. What a fun visit.
Yeah. That was awesome.
Yeah.
What a cool guy. Max Hodge was right.
Yeah, he was right on target. Our thanks to Max Hodge at Fasig Tipton for steering us in that direction. He said, you'll love his story. He's very colorful. And, you know, Max, you were 100% correct with that one.
Spot on.
He was talking at some points during that visit, and it made me think of you, especially when he mentioned New Orleans being his favorite town, because you always rave about New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like we're brothers from another mother or something.
Have a few pints.
Yeah.
Hit New Orleans, run them back in 1 week. What the heck?
Yeah, all of those things. Very important.
All right, don't forget, you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. Do it now. It's horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk.